This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 12th of September. Sir Keir Starmer is flying to Washington for a meeting with Joe Biden as President Putin tells the West that giving permission for Ukraine to use its long-range missiles to attack targets inside Russia would amount to NATO declaring war on his country. We'll discuss the implications with the former UK ambassador to Washington. After the closure of Scotland's last oil refinery at Grangemouth was confirmed, we speak to the local MSP and ask how it fits into plans for a just transition away from fossil fuels. Plus, the woman who has smashed the record for cycling around the world and the former Cocteau twin Simon Raymonde on being reduced to tears in the recording studio by the voice of the singer Elizabeth Fraser. Any visit to Washington by a new British Prime Minister is usually dominated by questions about the special relationship. But hovering over Sir Keir Starmer's meeting with Joe Biden in the White House tomorrow, his second since he was elected, is the feeling that there is a lot more at stake than simply keeping the bilateral relationship on a steady footing. With the growing impression that the West may be about to lift its restrictions on Ukraine using long-range missiles to attack targets in Russia, President Putin issued this warning on Russian state television today.
If this decision is made, it will mean nothing less than the direct participation of NATO countries, the United States and European countries, in the war in Ukraine. This is their direct participation. And this, of course, significantly changes the very essence, the very nature of the conflict.
Well, our correspondent Ione Wells is in Washington and joins us now. An upping of the rhetorical ante there from President Putin. What is actually being said in advance of this meeting about long-range missiles and whether Sir Keir Starmer and President Biden are minded to allow Ukraine to use them to attack Russian targets?
Well, that is certainly the matter that will be discussed by Sir Keir Starmer and the US President Biden as well. As you say, Western support for Ukraine and specifically this issue of whether Ukraine would be able to use Western-provided long-range missiles against Russian targets is what's likely to be discussed. The UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy said earlier this week when he and the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Kyiv that the delivery of Iranian missiles to Russia had changed the debate about Ukraine using those weapons, a suggestion there that this policy could be about to change. Now, the Ukrainian President Zelensky has called for allies to loosen their limits on Western supplied weapons, allow them essentially to use those long range missiles against Russia. The US and UK previously haven't allowed this because they fear that it could lead to escalation in a very severe way from Russia. And I think that's what that statement that we just heard there from President Putin is certainly trying to at least suggest, saying that if the US and UK were to allow this, this would mean NATO countries participating, and therefore, I think by implication, the suggestion that NATO countries could become potentially the target for reciprocal sort of retaliatory action from Russia themselves, potentially. I think that is certainly what he is at least trying to allude to. So I think this is what is going to be decided. No decision has been officially made yet, but it will be the topic of discussion between the two world leaders.
Well, thanks, Ione. Yeah, we'll see what happens. That was Ione Wells, our correspondent in Washington. Let's speak to Lord Darroch, who was the British ambassador in Washington between 2016 and 2019. He's also a former UK national security advisor and is on the line now. Good evening, Lord Darroch.
Good evening.
What do you make of President Putin's words and what impact they might have on this meeting between the UK and US leaders?
I think Putin's words are what you'd expect him to say. He won't like the idea of Britain and the US allowing their weapons to be used to attack Russian soil. And this is the sort of threat that you would expect him to make. And in both capitals, Washington and London, there will be calculations now about the extent to which he means it and the risk that is being taken, because there is a risk here. Question in my mind, actually, at this stage is, given that the Russians are making very slow, but nevertheless some progress in Ukraine, they're gaining a few yards every day, even if it's at huge cost in terms of casualties. How relevant to the next phase of this battle would this move that President Zelensky is asking for be? I just wonder whether the risks are worth the benefits at this stage, but that's not something from outside that one can easily calculate. It'll be a real discussion tomorrow between Biden and Starmer.
Now, on the programme yesterday, the former Defence Secretary Grant Shapps was talking about Britain having a unique leading role in the way that the whole conflict in Ukraine has played out. I mean, is that something that the Americans have appreciated, or have they felt at times that they're going further than they might have liked to?
No, I think it's been appreciated. I think that Brexit, not to argue about its impact in the UK, but in terms of the transatlantic relationship, Brexit was a setback because we had been the channel into the European Union for the Americans, and now we're not around that table. But we still bring value to the relationship through being the second biggest contributor to NATO, permanent member of the UN Security Council, global foreign policy. And I think, actually, that we've regained some credibility through the role we've played on Ukraine. Although you can't get away from the reality that the Americans are still providing the majority of the weapons and support, military support that is reaching Ukraine. But we've done okay.
Now, Sir Keir Starmer was asked on the plane over about the fact he wasn't going to be meeting the Democratic nominee for President Kamala Harris or indeed Donald Trump during this visit. And he said it's normal. You'd expect them to be out campaigning in the swing states. But he is, of course, talking to someone who's only going to be in post for another few months, isn't he? Clearly, though, the election will be on his mind, President Biden's as well, in terms of what it means for the war in Ukraine and other policies as well.
Yeah. First of all, I think that if you're going to see the candidates, you have to see both of them. So I would have been a bit concerned if the Prime Minister had just been seeing Kamala Harris and hadn't seen Donald Trump. So I think it's important. I mean, this election's on a knife edge, and you don't want to appear to be giving any favour to either side. So I think you should either see both or neither of them. In terms of the discussions with Biden, I am sure that they will, but Starmer will at some point, whether informally or actually in the plenary meeting, say, so how are things going? What's your assessment? But, they have a lot of current business. I mean, the world doesn't stop because the US election campaign is going on. And you have Ukraine, you have Gaza, you have the challenge from China. There's a lot going on in the world. So there's plenty of real business to be done, irrespective of the campaign that is running at the moment, and the fact that Biden only has another couple of months in office.
Lord Darroch, former British ambassador in Washington, thanks very much. Coming up later on in the programme, those eyes, that mouth, that voice.
The music has its own merits, but without the vocals of Elizabeth Fraser, it's just beautiful music. But she takes it and makes it transcendent, there's no doubt about that.
Simon Raymond there, one third of the indie trio, the Cocteau Twins. I've been speaking to him about the band as he releases his memoirs.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, cast your mind back to September 1952, if you can, and a royal visit to Scotland.
Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, has visited the newly extended £15 million refinery in Grangemouth, Scotland. Here she saw the £4 million catalytic cracking plant designed to produce high-quality petrol. It was certainly a memorable day for Grangemouth, for this was only the second time in the 200 years of its history that the town had received royalty.
Well, today, 72 years after that royal visit, the oil workers at the Grangemouth refinery were told the plant would be closing by the end of next summer. Petroineos, the company which owns the site, had signalled back in November that it intended to close Scotland's only oil refinery, but the unions had hoped it could be kept open long enough for a fossil fuel-free alternative to replace it and the jobs there. Instead, under a joint plan from the SNP-led Scottish Government and the Labour-led UK one, the site will be converted into a terminal where imported petrol, diesel and aviation fuel and kerosene can be stored, with a loss of around 400 jobs. Well, workers have, of course, lamented that decision.
I live just a stone's throw away from Grangemouth and from the refinery. Of course, it's dominated the skyline and it's dominated the employment market. But it's a really worrying and unsettling time for the workforce at Grangemouth today. There's tonight a lot of anger I've picked up. There's a lot of disappointment. There's a lot of nervousness, a lot of worry. And I know there's people looking offshore. There's people looking to move abroad to the Middle East, for example, to take up opportunities. Straight away, I'm looking at, well, where do I go? Because the jobs certainly aren't in this area at present. And on that basis, it is looking pretty grim.
And that was Chris Hamilton, who's a plant operator who works at the refinery. Well, the BBC Scotland editor is James Cook. So what's the company that owns the refinery saying about its decision?
Petroineos, in a nutshell, says that it's losing money, that the refinery, which is the oldest in the UK, it's a century old now, is losing so much money that they are not willing to continue investing in it. We've been told that the losses in the last week or so have amounted to around $500,000. That's about £380,000 a day. So the owner's position is, we need to move away from this business because the global market for fuels is competitive and declining as a result of the move away from petrol and diesel vehicles towards cars that have electric technology. So all of that taken together is the reason behind the company's decision.
Now, the SNP has found itself quite conflicted on the question of the future of fossil fuels in Scotland, hasn't it? How have they been reacting to the announcement?
North Sea oil particularly has been central to the case for Scottish independence for decades, less so in the last decade or so. But there is definitely a deep attachment between many people in the nationalist movement in Scotland and oil and gas. And for some people, that is epitomised by the fact that Scotland does have a refinery, the last remaining refinery in the country. Having said that, both the Scottish Government, run by the SNP, and the UK Government under now Labour, are very much of the mindset that the country needs to transition away, that they accept that climate change means that we need to shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. What's really striking today is that for the first time in a long time, there was a joint statement, a really detailed joint statement from both of those governments pledging to work together to inject, they say, £100 million into the local economy to support the workers and to explore longer term prospects for this site. They've got an idea called Project Willow, which is looking at what they could do in the long term. The short term plan here is they're going to start importing fuel. So it will come in not by pipeline as it does right now from the west coast of Scotland. It's delivered by tanker and sent in by pipeline, the crude oil. They don't actually refine crude oil from the North Sea here. That's going to stop. What they're going to start doing is bringing in refined petrol and diesel and then shipping it out to petrol stations around the country from there. But the longer term plan is to see whether they could create more greener fuel technology on this site. That's obviously a longer term aspiration, and it hasn't come in time to help the 400 or so people who are losing their jobs.
Yet despite all this, there was this rather surprise, beyond last minute, it would seem, intervention today from the local MSP, Michelle Thompson. She has claimed that she's been in touch with a potential buyer. Just tell us what she said.
She says she has found what could be a potential buyer for the site. She's confirmed it's an international company not based in Russia. Says she's had discussions with the firm and had informed the First Minister about this potential buyer during First Minister's question time at Holyrood at the Scottish Parliament this afternoon. For the owners of the site, Petro Ineos, their feeling really is that this site has been very obviously for sale if anyone wanted to buy it for quite a long time. They say it's nearly a year since they first signalled their intention to stop refining at Grangemouth. There had been plenty of time for potential buyers to express an interest, and Petro Ineos says we would have engaged seriously with any credible proposition. They say they've approached Michelle Thompson with a view to understanding her position.
The BBC Scotland editor, James Cook. Well, let's hear now from Michelle Thompson. She's the SNP MSP for Falkirk East and, as we heard, has spoken about a potential buyer for the refinery. I asked her what she could tell us about them.
Based on the engagement I've had thus far, it is a serious player and a serious proposition. I can also confirm that they are North American and that they are not seeking any government funding, i.e. from either the UK government or the Scottish government. And active dialogue is now in train.
Well, does that dialogue, I assume, it will involve Petro Ineos? Because we've spoken to them and others have, and they have made the point it's nearly a year since they first signalled their intention to stop refining at Grangemouth. So What do you understand about the timing of this from the party that you've been speaking to?
It's entirely coincidence, because I'm in the business of keeping close counsel. I have to, as I've signed a non-disclosure agreement, so I must be careful and sensitive. They, of course, had absolutely no idea about the announcement today. For any deal to go forward, there has to be a willing buyer and there has to be a willing seller. Whether some kind of deal can be done, and I don't know, but I have a duty and an obligation to try and do the right thing for my constituency and constituents.
Does that mean that the conversation, or at least the first step towards the conversation, has been initiated between Petro Ineos and the prospective buyer that you have been in touch with?
On that note, I'm going to decline to answer. This is deeply commercially sensitive, and I think it's entirely appropriate that all parties have the chance to conduct any conversations in private.
Understood. Again, no, you've been very clear. Well, look, let's move on in that case, because if no deal is done, as things stand, around 400 employees of the Petro Ineos refinery are going to lose their jobs. What kind of impact is that going to have on local people in your constituency?
The people of Grangemouth refer to their economy as a DIDO economy, which they say stands for drive in, drive out, and expresses the fact that many of the people, obviously not all, actually don't live in Grangemouth and live nearby areas such as Edinburgh and Glasgow. Nevertheless, I anticipate, should a deal not be able to be done, that there will be an impact. There's considerable social deprivation, and I would really be deeply fearful that that would be a blow to the town, but also the surrounding area.
You don't fear that with the timing of you making this public, that you are giving false hope to hundreds of families, potentially?
I've been very careful in the language I've chosen to use. I can say with complete integrity, I believe that potential buyer to be serious. And if anyone is disappointed, I deeply regret that. Equally, against that, I will do my best for my constituency. That is what I was elected to do, and that's what I'm going to do.
That was Michelle Thompson, the SNP MSP for Falkirk East. Well, let's look at how this fits into the broader picture of Britain's transition away from fossil fuels and whether or not it could be a just one. Professor Paul DeLeo is director of the Energy Transition Institute at Robert Gordon University and joins us now. Good evening, Professor DeLeo.
Good evening.
First of all, when it comes to Grangemouth, was the decision to close it inevitable?
Yeah, I mean, it was no surprise. You go back 50 years, 1970s, we had 18 refineries in the United Kingdom. We now have six. And if you play the energy transition out, we're going to use less oil and gas, we're going to use fewer petrol and diesel in the future, we're actually going to end up with fewer refineries than we have now. So yes, it is part of the energy transition, it's part of a journey, but it is a landmark moment because this is such a symbolic asset for Scotland at this point in time.
Beyond the symbolism, of course, is the direct impact on people who are losing their jobs? And how do you carry out this transition in a way that is fair, in a way that keeps people employed? How do you create transferable skills?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important because I think it's bigger than just the direct job announcement we heard today, because of course there are people working in the supply chain, there are people working in other parts of it. So PwC report this morning highlighted there's a 2,800 jobs potentially impacted by all this. 4% of Scottish GDP kind of hangs on the back of this. So this is actually quite a big kind of issue, not just for Grange Mountain and the people working and being affected here, but also for the wider kind of Scottish economy. Because what we see happening here, we're going to happen to the oil and gas workers in the very near future, because they have a similar challenge here. And this is about integrated transition planning, so that we can actually make sure that the timing of one activity like Grange Mountain refining shutting down or oil and gas activity stopping, we can take these skills and capabilities and the supply chain strength we have in Scotland and move it to other industries like the wind, carbon capture storage or hydrogen industries. And that integrated planning needs to happen, because this is an example where it is not happening.
Yes, I was going to say, there's been a question from the company, at least, about why people might be coming up with potentially last-minute offers when this has been a year in the making, or they set out a year ago they planned to do this. Why have plans not been put in place?
I think this is all about integrated planning and actually making sure if we want to do a just and fair transition where we actually take the communities with us, take the workforce with us, keep the supply chain capability, it is kind of take long-term planning. If we really want to say is we're going to repurpose the site for a biorefinery or sustainable aviation fuels or for hydrogen, that's going to take time. We will not have that in place by the middle of next year when these people are unfortunately exposed, when the jobs might disappear. So it is actually, this takes far longer timing and planning, and we just need to learn from this and saying is how can we do this, not just for Grange Mountain, but also for the oil and gas industry and other fossil fuel areas which are going to be affected and going to see the same impact.
So lessons to be drawn from this. Professor Paul DeLeo, Director of the Energy Transition Institute at Robert Gordon University, thanks very much. Now, social care may have been outside the formal scope of the investigation. Those are the words of Lord Darcy. He was, of course, the author of the government-commissioned report on the NHS. But the surgeon, former Labour minister, found it impossible to separate what he called the dire state of social care from the challenges facing NHS hospitals. And he quantified the link. He said, with 13% of NHS beds occupied by people waiting for social care support or care in more appropriate settings, there are 7% fewer daily outpatient appointments for each consultant, 12% less surgical activity for each surgeon, and 18% less activity for each clinician working in emergency medicine. Well, Stephen Kinnock is Minister of State for Care. Speaking on the PM programme this evening, he talked about the government's response, which is a 10-year plan for the NHS involving three major shifts from analogue to digital, from hospital to community care, and from treating sickness to preventing it.
The 10-year plan that we are going to be setting out is going to start with a major national conversation, public engagement all over the country, which is really going to bring in both people with lived experience, patients and staff to shape that 10-year plan, as I've set out the three major shifts that that is going to deliver. That plan will be ready to feed in to the comprehensive spending review in the spring of next year. So we're looking at that plan being published in the spring of next year. That will set out the major surgery that we're going to have to perform in order to rescue our NHS and social care and rebuild it, reform it, and reimagine it so that it can once again be a health and care service that our country can be proud of.
Well, someone who knows about reimagining the funding of social care in England is Sir Andrew Dilnot. He did it more than a decade ago when he chaired the commission looking into how to deliver a fair, affordable and sustainably funded social care system that established the principle of a cap on social care costs for individuals, the long-delayed implementation of which the current government has now postponed indefinitely. And Sir Andrew is on the line. Good evening.
Good evening.
As far as this report from Lord Darcy is concerned, were you surprised when it came to what he had to say about social care?
No, not surprised at all. And I don't think anybody who's looked at this at all would be surprised. We've known for 30 years that social care was inadequate in this country. It's grown more inadequate pretty much every year. Over the last 30 years, it's now in crisis, and the crisis in social care is now so bad that it's definitely, as Lord Darcy in his report said, having a detrimental impact on the NHS. So even if we shouldn't reform social care, because if we want to live in a decent country, we should have a social care system that works, and we should do it for just that reason. We now have an additional reason, which is that it's so bad that it's doing damage to the NHS.
What about the time frame? A 10-year plan from the government. Lord Darcy says it's going to take 5 to 8 years to fix the NHS. I mean, what kind of urgency would you say the government needs to apply to this?
I think it's unbelievably urgent. We've now had a set of reforms based on the suggestions that we made back in 2011, promised by three different political setups. The Conservative government, the coalition government in 2014 promised to do it in 2016. In 2015, it was postponed. Boris Johnson's government promised to do it in October 2023 when his government came to an end. The subsequent Conservative governments abolished it. And then the Labour government, the Labour Party, in the run-up to the election, made a clear and explicit on-the-record guarantee that they would do it, and then 3 weeks after the election said no. Every time we fail to do this, we're letting down hundreds of thousands of families and the people in those families who need care. And we're also letting down the people who work in the sector, as well as letting ourselves down, because it means that we're living in a country that doesn't have a way of helping those in some of the most difficult and stressful times that any of us will face be properly looked after. So it's really, really urgent, and it's pretty frustrating that we're not just getting on with it.
What does getting on with it look like, though? How do you get those thousands of people who are stuck in hospital beds when they could and should be recovering at home or in other settings? What do you do? How do you get the people, the numbers to work in the sector and all the other issues that need fixing?
So there are two big things that we need to do. The first thing is that we need to fund the existing means-tested system adequately. There are fewer people getting help from the means-tested system now than there were 10 years ago, despite a massive increase in the numbers who need it. Every year, the Treasury ends up allocating extra funds to social care. That's not a grown-up or sensible way of carrying on. Since we know that we're going to have to add at least £1 billion a year to social care every year, wouldn't it be more sensible to say, here's a five-year settlement, you're going to get this amount, and actually do it in advance? That's the first thing. But the second critical element is that we need to find a system that works for the whole of society. And that means, as we do in every other area of our welfare provision, pooling risks across the whole community. We don't say to somebody who ends up with a really serious health problem that they have to bear the cost of that unless they have very, very little income and wealth. We shouldn't be saying that in social care. If we did that, we would get more money being spent. We would give security to the people involved, both as the deliverers of care and as the recipients. Sir, it's pretty straightforward. Everybody understands it. We should just get on with it.
Sir Andrew Dilnot, thanks very much. Now, quite a few cycling world records were broken at the Paris Olympics, usually by fractions of a second. But Lael Wilcox has just broken a cycling record by 16 days. That's right, days. The 38-year-old endurance cyclist from Alaska has become the fastest woman to circumnavigate the globe on two wheels. She started and finished in the same city, Chicago. That was Lael being cheered across the finishing line late last night by her friends and family. Well, I spoke to her and to her wife, Rue Kaladit, an endurance sport photographer who followed Lael throughout the journey to make a documentary of it. And I began by asking Lael herself how she felt completing the journey.
I just started crying. I was in just total beauty, and my parents were there, and so many kind people cheering, and it just felt incredible to be back.
It must have been a hugely challenging experience. What were the highs and the lows?
I had invited people from all over the world to come share some distance with me or come out and say hello, and so I met thousands of people out there. You know, people would come out with cargo bikes with their kids on board. Everybody had such a cool story. So to be part of their world felt really, really cool.
And it was all being documented by your other half, wasn't it, Rue, who is with
yeah.
you.
Hi.
Hi, Rue. So tell us about your role in all of this.
Yeah, I was having my own ultra distance event. documenting Lael and following her around the world. I'm a professional photojournalist, and this is kind of, I would say, the dream.
You are used to doing your job, taking these photos over long distances. Is it different, though, when you are taking photographs of your wife, documenting her journey in this way?
One of the benefits is just that we're so kind of comfortable with each other, right? So I think if it was somebody else that was biking around the world, there are going to be moments where the last thing that they want is to have like a camera in their face. Day 4, Lael was in a thunderstorm, fixing a flat tire, and she had gotten sick and was vomiting. And although I tried my best not to invade her privacy, it's like that's kind of part of the story. There are these highs and lows, and it's special that she's able to share this journey with me and with the world.
Yeah, I suppose if anyone's going to take a photograph of you while you're vomiting, your wife's probably the only one who you wouldn't mind doing that. You've given us an insight into just how grueling it is, because it all sounds like fun and excitement. But perhaps if Lael, I can have the last word with you. I was going to say, where do you go next? There's literally nowhere to go, I guess. In terms of your endurance cycling, once you've been around the world, where do you go?
I'll go on a little bike trip with my mom and dad and aunts and uncles and cousins next week, and that'll be a lot slower pace, but another way to spend time outside on the bike.
Is that back in Anchorage?
Actually, kind of in the east coast of the US.
Right. I was going to come up with a line of, I remember that song, Anchored Down in Anchorage, but you're not really you're not really one to be anchored down anywhere by the sound of things.
Oh, you know, I will love to spend some time at home after all this.
Lael Wilcox, her wife Rue, and for the record was 108 days, 12 hours and 12 minutes. Now, he was one third of a band that many music fans would dearly love to see reform. Simon Raymond spent 14 years as bassist, keyboard player and songwriter with the indie legends from Scotland, the Cocteau Twins, before forming Bella Union, one of the UK's most successful independent record labels. In his new memoir, In One Ear, Cocteau Twins, Ivor and Me, Simon writes about his late father, the accomplished musical arranger and producer, Ivor Raymond, about living for more than 20 years with a brain tumour, which caused him to go deaf in one ear, and about his time in the Cocteau Twins. And he told me how he started playing with the other two band members, guitarist Robin Guthrie and unique lead singer Elizabeth Fraser.
Just a complete freak accident, really. I was working in a little 8-track studio over in Camden and had invited the band over because I knew they were sort of fed up working with producers and engineers that they didn't totally see eye to eye with. I don't know how it happened, but we just started recording a song together. I think they thought I'd invited them to write some music with them, and I was really not at all thinking that. I just said, I'll make you some tea and you can get on with it. And then, you know, Liz popped out for some chips, and then an hour later we had this piece of music recorded. It's called Millie Millinery. Maybe a month or so later, Robin called me up and asked me if I'd like to come up and record a whole record with them and join the band. And I didn't really need a second to think about it.
Cocteau Twins fans desperate to know the secret of your very unique sound. You give away some of the secrets. You give away some of the rules that you had when you were recording, and one of them was don't go in with a song.
Yeah, go in with nothing, actually, with no preconceived ideas, no melodies, no nothing, not even prepared, not even rehearsed in advance. And I found that quite terrifying because I barely knew the people I was writing and recording with. Robin was so supremely confident in what he had in his head and how he would sort of make that come out of the speakers at the other end, that I just sort of went along with it and thought, oh, I guess this is normal. And now looking back on it, I'm like, how did that happen? That just seems such a strange way to write music. But I still do it exactly the same way now, so I guess it's not that strange at all.
The music, and then, of course, on top of it, the vocals.
The music has its own merits, but without the vocals of Elizabeth Fraser, it's just beautiful music. But she takes it and makes it transcendent. There's no doubt about that.
You clearly have a huge appreciation for her as a singer, someone who can move you. And I was really struck when you say, I think later in the book, that you would actually, and this is a quote, I think, discreetly wiping the tears from your eyes when you were listening to her sing.
Yeah, because it's not something you've ever heard before. When it's coming out of her mouth and she says, oh, I'm ready to record now, it's like walking into a gallery and seeing a painting for the very first time. So your guts, your gut reaction to it is the honest one. And yeah, I mean, sometimes your body just does what it does, right? And you can't stop. But of course, I didn't let her see that because that would have been very unprofessional and she probably might have been embarrassed. So, you know, I was just like, yep, that was good, Liz. All good.
So meanwhile, yeah.
Just thinking, oh my God, you know, it's just a real privilege is what it is to be in the vicinity of somebody who's that blessed with such a raw talent. And I think she goes to a place that very few singers go to, you know, somewhere deep down, right down further than most singers are willing to go, are sort of showing that vulnerability, whatever it is, or just that raw emotion.
Cocteau Twins, I guess, have a reputation of being a pretty sort of serious band. But there is humour there, isn't there? I think any band that records a cover version of Frosty the Snowman can't be totally serious.
I think we sort of wanted to kind of mess around with people's heads a bit. You know, why not? Like, the Beach Boys did it. Frank Sinatra did it. We just recently signed to Capitol Records, the label that both of those artists were on, and we just thought it would be funny if we did a Christmas album. We never quite got that far. I think after two, we were like, yeah, I think the joke is kind of wearing a little thin. But it was kind of fun for a moment or two.
The end, though, I guess must have been tough, the end of the Cocteau Twins. I mean, Robin's drug issues have been well documented, but it does strike me, you know, when you got the phone call from Elizabeth saying, and that's it, that must have been a tough time for you. You didn't want it to end, did you?
No. I mean, even though they had broken up as a couple several years prior to this, and perhaps the band would have made sense if the band had broken up then too. You know, I wouldn't have even been remotely surprised because I was certainly expecting it then. The fact that we had actually managed to say exist as a band for the next two albums, it still was a shock, even though, yeah, I totally understood why she found it impossible to continue. It was probably a miracle she got that far at all. But yeah, I mean, having set up the label a few months earlier that started Bell Union with a view to putting out Cocteau Twins records, then having this label and no band, it did sort of maybe speed up, you know, what happened to me next, which was diving straight into that.
2001 was a very important year for you when you got your diagnosis, wasn't it? I mean, the title of the book, In One Ear, refers to the fact you are deaf in one ear.
Yes, I have a brain tumour, an acoustic neuroma, it's technically called.
And the hearing never came back?
No, it would never come back.
I mean, how's that been for someone like you who lives and breathes music and is constantly listening to new bands? And
well, I'm totally used to it, right? And it doesn't inhibit me in too many ways, really. I'm not ashamed of it, but I think I was sort of perhaps frightened that my integrity as a producer or as a musician or as an A&R man would be compromised. But I mean, if I just turn to the side, I hear the same thing. It's obviously not in stereo, but I've gotten very so used to it, and I still think I'm a great judge of music.
And that was Simon Raymond, formerly a Cocteau Twin and who runs the record label Bella Union. His new memoir was published today. Our closing headline tonight, President Putin has told Russian state TV he would consider Ukraine using Western-supplied missiles on targets inside his country, a declaration of war by NATO. In response, Keir Starmer said Russia had started the conflict and had the power to end the war in Ukraine. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami from all of us here. Have a very good night.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.